Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Job chapter 10. I'll call this chapter, Job Continues, A Plea to God. Our context is this. In our last chapter, Job is replying to Bildad the Shuhite, and he's saying to Bildad, and he's also complaining to God, and he's saying, there is no arbiter, there's nobody to adjudicate my case in controversy before the Lord. I didn't do anything to deserve all this suffering. Now, up until this point, Job has not denied the justice of God, the righteousness of God. He's held fast his integrity. He, however, has complained to God that God has not given him a chance to defend himself. And God has not told him why Job is suffering so much. So he is complaining about that, but he doesn't complain about the justice of God. He's basically saying God is God. He can do what he wants to do. He doesn't have to tell me anything. I don't like it. But God is God, and he's just. He knows what he's doing. And so Job is continuing here in chapter 10. We'll start with verses 1 through 3. I loathe my own life, Job says. I will give full vent to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend with me. Is it right for you indeed to oppress, to reject the labor of your hands, and to look favorably on the schemes of the wicked? So Job is complaining. Now he says, I give full vent to my complaint. His complaint is, let me know why you're contending with me. Why are you doing this to me? Again, he's not questioning God's justice. He just wants to know why. Now when he says in verse 2, I will say to God, do not condemn me. He doesn't mean condemn in the eternal sense. He means temporarily. Don't condemn me to lack of knowledge about my suffering. Job never once worries about going to hell, that God is getting ready to send him to hell. Not once does that occur in his mind. NIV Study Bible says here that Job was not being rebellious or arrogant when he asked why God is contending with him. He simply wanted to know the reasons for his suffering. But the larger issue, which is not mentioned until later, is that the sovereign God can decide to withhold information from us. Though we understand the reasons behind Job's suffering from chapters 1 and 2, we don't know why God thought it best to leave Job in the dark. Well, a good application point there is why does God leave us in the dark sometimes? Because by golly, he does. And it is not ours to question why. Now, Job is asking why. It's an honest question. He is conscious of no sin in himself that could have brought on such intense punishment. He was not aware that God can indirectly cause evil things to happen to us for our training and strengthening. He's about to learn the lesson of Job, the lesson that all Christians have to learn at some point or another. Now, in verse 3, Job says, God, is it right for you to oppress me? Well, of course, Job doesn't think it's right for God to do what he's done by not telling him what's going on. Is it right for you to reject the labor of your hands? Job is the labor of God's hands because God made Job. God, is it right for you to look favorably on the schemes of the wicked? Now, who are the wicked there? It could be Satan. It could be wicked people in general. Most probably, I think it's the Sabaeans who took his oxen and donkey from him, and the Chaldeans who stole his camel and killed his servants. Those were some schemes that were perpetrated against Job. Go now to Job 10, verses 4 through 7. God continues to hear Job's complaints. Job says, have you eyes of flesh? Have you, God, eyes of flesh? Or do you see as a man sees? Are your days as the days of a mortal, or your years as man's years, that you should seek for my guilt and search after my sin? According to your knowledge, I am indeed not guilty, yet there is no deliverance from your hand. In verse 4, when Job says, do you, God, have eyes of flesh? That's the same thing as saying, do you see as a man sees, which he repeats in the second part of the verse. Now, what does that mean? Well, there's a couple of ways you could take that. One way is men take a while to find out something. They have to investigate. They have to get a private investigator. They have to think. They have to reason. God doesn't need to do that. He could look at Job immediately and say, ah, there's your sin, Job. But he doesn't do it. There's the reason, Job. He could do it instantly. He doesn't have to wait like men do. He sees instantly, not as men see. That's one way you could take it. Or another way you could take it is Job is saying, look, God, do you see evilly as a man sees? Do you see, for instance, the way my false friends see, searching out my guilt, accusing me of all kinds of sin? As John Gill puts it, Dost thou envy me my former prosperity and peace, that thou searchest so narrowly into my conduct to find iniquity in me and take advantage against me? In other words, are you seeking after me with the evil eye that men of flesh do when they look upon the affairs of men? Adam Clark puts it this way, puts the words in Job's mouth. Is it becoming thy infinite dignity to concern thyself so much with the affairs or transgressions of a despicable mortal? In other words, are you looking at things the way that I see things? So the way a man sees might be man in general. He takes a while to see. God sees quickly. That's option one. Or do you see as a man sees? Do you see the way that evil men see, like my three false friends? Or number three, do you see the way things that I, Job, see, that you would bother to mess with such lowly affairs that I'm looking at? Verse 5, Job says, are your days as the days of a mortal, or your years as man's years? Well, obviously the answer is no. God has all the time in the world to find out Job's sins. Plus, he's omniscient. So there's no need for him to afflict Job so as to discover Job's sin. Why are you doing this to me, God? I'm not hiding anything. You don't need to torture me to get information out of me. I'll give it to you gladly. I don't have anything to hide. So why are you doing this? Why is it that you should seek for my guilt and search after my sin? According to your knowledge, I am indeed not guilty. In other words, through your vision, God, and the length of time that you have, you're not merely mortal but divine. But you still can't find sin in me. So Job still holds to his innocence in the face of the accusations of his false friends. Job says, I'm not guilty. I didn't do anything to deserve this. And yet there is no deliverance from your hand. And yet you still torture me, God, by not telling me what's going on. Now, in verse 7, when Job says, I am indeed not guilty, he doesn't mean that he's sinlessly perfect. He's not some kind of Wesleyan Arminian here saying, hey, I've attained sinless perfection with intentional sins, at least. No, that's not what he's saying. He's saying, I am not guilty of any transgression that could justify this horrible sin I'm going through. That's what he's claiming. As John Gill points out here, we could quote Job 7:20 as one example of many of how Job is claiming his innocence. He says, have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? What have I done to you, God, O watcher of men? Why have you, God, set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? Have I sinned? And of course, that's a rhetorical question that means no, he hasn't sinned. We go to Job 10, verses 8 through 12. Job continues to speak to God. Your hands fashioned and made me altogether, and would you destroy me? Remember now that you have made me as clay, and would you turn me into dust again? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese, clothe me with skin and flesh, and knit me together with bones and sinews? You have granted me life and loving kindness, and your care has preserved my spirit. Now, when Job says in verse 8, your hands fashioned and made me altogether, he is enlarging on what he just said in verse 3 of this chapter, chapter 10. When Job says to God, is it right for you to oppress, to reject the labor of your hands? In other words, he's saying that God made Job like clay. Why would God reject his own creation? Your hands fashioned me. And now you're going to destroy me? That makes no sense. In verse 9, Job says, remember now, God, you have made me as clay. Now that doesn't refer to the perishable nature of clay. It refers rather to the wonderful fashioning by the divine potter. You have made me as a beautiful clay statue, if you will, a beautiful clay sculpture, if you will. And would you take that beautiful sculpture and turn it into dust again? A lot of times we hear the metaphor, I'm just clay, I'm made out of clay, jars of clay. And the idea is the weakness of clay, the lowliness of clay. That's not what he's talking about here. Here he's talking about, you have made me as a beautiful clay statue. And why would you turn it into dust again and destroy it? Verse 10, did you not pour me out like milk? Now, there's a couple of interesting options here. Let's take the most obvious one first. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that milk is a symbol of purity and holiness. Quoting Lamentations 4, verse 7, her consecrated ones were purer than snow. They were whiter than milk, because milk is white, pure is white, no dirt in there, no black in the middle of the white. And so that would make sense. Job is saying, hey, didn't you pour me out like pure milk? And then, of course, the milk gets curdled like cheese as it gets made into something solid, even as a human body gets made into something solid. Now, the other option here as to what Job is talking about when he says, did you not pour me out like milk, is real interesting. Gill and Clark say that refers to the semen of Job's father. Did you not pour me out like milk when Job's semen fell into the womb and then became curdled into a human being? The milk, or the semen, coagulates and hardens into a human being. Jameson, Foss, and Brown put it this way, quote, in the organization of the body from its rude commencements, the original liquid gradually assumes a more solid consistency, like milk curdling into cheese. The original liquid, referring, of course, to Job's father's semen. I really think that's a stretch. I don't know what it is about these 19th century commentators. They seem to be fixated on this. But at any rate, it doesn't matter. Job in verse 11 says, God, you've clothed me with skin and flesh. You've knit me together. You've made me into a life. You've granted me life and loving kindness. Your care has preserved my spirit. So why don't you tell me what's going on? Job 10, verses 13 through 14, Job continues, yet these things you have concealed in your heart. I know that this is within you. If I sinned, then you would take note of me and would not acquit me of my guilt. Now, what things has God concealed in his heart? Well, the obvious option, or the first option, is all the good things that God had formerly blessed Job with, made him like a clay statue, made him the labor of his hands, granted Job life and loving kindness, preserved Job's spirit. Well, all those good things, now you've hidden in your heart. You don't let it be known anymore because you're causing me all this grief. It could be that, or the things that have been concealed in God's heart that Job is referring to is God's eternal purpose to afflict him when God made him. All these things you've concealed, the fact that you are afflicting me with all these troubles you've concealed in your heart as to why you're doing it. The NIV Study Bible says here that God's eye is on us continually, but not in the sense of trying to get us. Rather, God's love and concern cause him to watch us continually. Job's words, however, express his darkest thoughts and fears. More than likely, Job did not have access to any of God's written word that could have encouraged him to experience God's watchful mercy. All Job had for the moment was his experience of suffering. So that's option number two, is what has been concealed in God's heart. Why is Job suffering? Option number three, good things in the future that haven't happened yet. All these things you have concealed in your heart. I don't know how these things can refer to something mentioned in the future because there's no context there. Nothing that says that Job is referring to good things in the future, but that was concealed in God's heart and it was revealed later at the end of the book when things get happier. But right now, Job can't see anything good in the future, so we could say that these things are concealed in God's heart. I think of all the things, of the options that could have been concealed in God's heart, option number one, the good things that God had formerly blessed Job with, like his creation, his care and preservation of him. I don't think that's what Job is talking about here. I think the things that are concealed in God's heart that Job is talking about is the knowledge of why he's suffering from this sin. And I don't think it's referring to good things that are coming in the future that are hidden right now. We go now to Job 10, verses 15 through 17. Job continues, if I am wicked, woe to me, and if I am righteous, I dare not lift up my head. I am sated with disgrace and conscious of my misery. Should my head be lifted up, you would hunt me like a lion, and again you would show your power against me. You renew your witnesses against me and increase your anger toward me. Hardship after hardship is with me. Now Job again is complaining. He's not complaining that God is unrighteous, but he's complaining that God won't give him a forum to argue his case in controversy before the Lord, to argue his innocence. I didn't do anything to deserve this. And so he's just giving up. He's saying, okay, you're not going to give me some answers. Well, then I just don't care anymore. Verse 15, if I'm wicked, woe to me. And if I'm righteous, I dare not lift up my head. Doesn't make any difference. I'm screwed. Woe to me if I did do some kind of sin to deserve all this suffering. And if I didn't, and if I'm righteous, well, it doesn't make any difference. I can't lift up my head to argue with you because you're not going to listen to me because you're God and I'm a nobody. And again, when he says in verse 15, if I am righteous, he's not talking about sinless perfection. He's talking about if I didn't do anything to cause all this suffering. That's what he means by righteous. Job says, I am sated with disgrace. King James says, I am sated with confusion. Or the King James has confusion. I am sated with confusion and conscious of my misery. The NIV has drowned in my misery. The NIV note has, or I'm aware of my misery. Translation differences there. Verse 16, should my head be lifted up, you would hunt me like a lion. In other words, I'm not lifting my head up to you to complain, God. You're too big for me. Again, you would show your power against me. You lift your head up against a lion, you get your head torn off. Well, I'm not going to lift my head up against you, God, because you don't want to tell me what's going on, then you don't tell me what's going on. And then here's another complaint, though, in verse 17. You renew your witnesses against me. John Gill suggests those witnesses are demons witnessing against Job. I don't think so. John Gill suggests Job's false friends. That's probably true. Eliphaz and Bildad and the third one, whose name I can't remember right now. Zophar, I think it is. Or it could be the witnesses against Job or all the afflictions that tell everybody this man's a sinner. Look at all these afflictions that he has. Well, that term witnesses, that's another legal term, another forensic legal term that Job uses, because this is a case in controversy against God that we're going to end up in a courtroom scene eventually. And so Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that an accumulation of witnesses has come to the courtroom to wear out the accused, Job. We go now to Job 10, verses 18 through 22, and we will be finished with this chapter. Job continues, "Why then have you brought me out of the womb? Would that I had died, and no eye had seen me. I should have been as though I had not been, carried from womb to tomb. Would he not let my few days alone, he God, not let my few days alone? Withdraw from me, that I may have a little cheer," Job tells God. "Before I go, and I shall not return, to the land of darkness and deep shadow, the land of utter gloom as darkness itself, of deep shadow without order, and which shines as the darkness." In other words, before I shuffle off this mortal coil and shuffle on down to Sheol, how about leave me alone, God, so I can spend my last few minutes in this life without you? Now, that's bad. He doesn't want the presence of God anymore as he's about to die. Job once again says, "Why have you brought me out of the womb? Why was I ever born? Cursed the day that I was born." We saw him saying that in chapter 3, where Job laments his birth, and he's doing it again here. He says, "I wish nobody had seen me in this life. I wish I could have just been carried as I was born from the womb, carried to my tomb, and died before I had a chance to grow. I wanted to die as a baby." Verse 20, "Would he, God, not let my few days alone, the few days that I have on earth? I don't want to have those days complicated with you, God. Leave me alone. Withdraw from me, that I may have a little cheer, because you're causing me misery, God." Ooh, Job is really getting upset. And then he says in verse 21, "Before I go," in other words, "give me a little bit of time alone before I go into the land of death. And by the way, I'm not going to return to the land of darkness and deep shadow." Now, is he talking about damnation, going to hell? No, Job had no fault nor fear of such a state, as John Gill says. He's talking about the grave, or Sheol. Now, the Old Testament saints did have an idea of the afterlife. They believed that there would be a conscious afterlife. Here's what the NIV Study Bible says about that. Quote, "In ancient times, little was known about what happened after death. Lack of knowledge was frequently characterized as darkness. Knowledge was enlightenment. The mysteries of the hereafter seemed like deep darkness to people in Job's time. The land of the dead was considered as absolute night without a hint of light." But that still didn't mean that Job thought that you just disappeared, that you were just annihilated, that you went to sleep. Here's what Job thought about the afterlife. Job 19, verses 25 through 27. "As for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes will see, and not another. My heart faints within me. I know that my Redeemer lives." God's going to redeem him from all this mess. "Even after my skin is destroyed," in other words, even after I die, I'm going to see God. So he clearly believed in an afterlife. He didn't have a clear idea of what the afterlife was like. Some think that he even believed in a physical resurrection, but there's textual problems here. "As for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, yet from my flesh I shall see God." That sounds like he's resurrected and he's going to see God. But there are textual and translation difficulties there. I remember I wanted to use this verse against the hyper-preterist heretics who say that we're already resurrected and there's not going to be a future resurrection of the physical dead. And I said, oh, this is the perfect verse to use against them. But then I looked at it and says, ah, doggone it. A hyper-preterist heretic can say, there's a textual problem here. And they're right, there is. So we're not going to take a stand on that. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest that perhaps Job's misery clouded his otherwise cheerier view of the afterlife. Well, that's speculation. We don't know whether Job thought it was better than this or not. But we do know that at best, Job lacked the definite clearness of the Christian, because we note that Job in his misery does not have the comfort of an afterlife like Christians do, that eternal weight of glory that's waiting for us, the eternal mansions, the eternal kingdom forever and ever and ever, world without end, where we will see Jesus face to face even as he is. Job didn't have that. We have that in the New Testament. Thank God for it. So ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Job chapter 10. That prepares us to move on in our next audio to Job chapter 11. Now chapter 11 is entitled, Zophar Speaks, You Deserve Worse. Well, that's very encouraging. Zophar, Job's third false friend. I'll hope you stay tuned to acquaint yourself with the bile of Mr. Zophar in our next audio. And I hope you enjoyed this one.